Welcome to the World Science Podcast. It's May 29th, 2009. I'm David Cohn. We're coming to you from The World, which is a one-hour daily international news magazine that airs on public radio stations across the U.S. It's co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH right here in Boston. You can find out more at theworld.org. We're listening to The Clash, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Now, why is this song relevant? It's a song about choice. And this week's podcast is all about choice and choosing. We're going to be talking to Jonah Lehrer, who's the author of How We Decide, a new book on the neuroscience behind decision-making. A piece of the interview was on The World on the radio today, but we have a much longer version here. Jonah has a lot to say about something called the certainty trap, about the reckless decisions behind the global financial meltdown, and why sometimes it's possible to think too much about a decision. I can definitely attest to that. It's a good interview. It's fun. And today we are also rolling out our first ever interactive science forum. It's a place where you can meet some of the top scientists and science writers around, people like Jonah. Jonah, in fact, is going to be our first guest, and we'll be talking to him about decisions and how we decide stuff. And best of all, he's going to be in there checking in regularly, commenting and responding to what you say. The URL, again, is theworld.org/science. Let's get right to that interview. Jonah, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this book is all about how we make decisions, and a lot of it is about how people screw up decisions. And you looked at research from all over the world, and one key example is the 1973 Israeli-Arab War. Tell me about that.
Well, I use that example to illustrate what scientists sometimes refer to as the certainty trap or the sin of certainty, which is that people love believing they're right. And one of the unfortunate consequences of the fact that we love believing we're right, we love being certain, is that it's very easy for us to neglect evidence that we're not right, that we're wrong. And so that I think, is what happened when I came to the Israeli intelligence services in the run-up to the Yom Kippur War in 1973, which is that there was all this evidence that the Arab countries surrounding Israel were actually planning an attack.
There was a huge buildup on the border, right? And a massive buildup.
There was a huge buildup on the border, you know, in Syria and in Egypt. And the Egyptians said this is just a training exercise, but there were signs that this training exercise was actually kind of unprecedented. The Soviets had evacuated their training advisors. There was one piece of evidence after another that, in retrospect, seems glaringly obvious that something strange was going on.
It was like the opposite of the Iraq War in a way. It was like a huge amount of evidence that something was happening.
Exactly. And yet, because Israeli intelligence services were convinced, they were certain, they had this theory, which they called the concept, that the Arab countries wouldn't attack until they had enough fighter planes, especially,
right,
to counteract the Israeli air superiority. And that wouldn't happen until 1975 or so. So they had all these very good logical-sounding reasons why an invasion wasn't imminent. And those reasons, that those theories, which they were so certain of, led them to find all sorts of ways of discounting all this evidence which suggests an attack was actually imminent. So I use that to simply illustrate this bias we all have. You know, I think another glaring example of it came, you know, in the subprime mortgage crisis. So you had all these very, very well-trained, well-educated investors working for big, fancy hedge funds and big, fancy
right.
investment companies who had convinced themselves, they had these nifty equations showing that these subprime mortgages, when they'd been sliced and diced, weren't actually risky. They had, you know, this very complicated algorithm which they used to measure risk. And
right.
sure enough, that algorithm, along with Moody's and all the rest, said these things weren't risky. And what they didn't question was the underlying assumption. Well, what happens if real estate prices go down across the country at the same
right.
time? So they locked on to this belief, this belief they were so certain of, that these things weren't actually risky.
This faulty idea was that in one case was that they're not going to attack until 75, and in
yeah.
the other case it was that the real estate market will never go down or won't go down in any time soon.
Yeah, or you know, in particular, the assumption was that it might go down in Phoenix or it might go down in Vegas, but it won't go down across the country all at the same time.
Right.
And by splicing and dicing them, and mixing them all together in this big pool, you'll counteract those regional disturbances. But I think this is what people are so often bad at, is questioning the underlying assumptions at work. We become so blind to those assumptions, we just develop these nifty, neat, clever models, and we don't question what make those models work and why those models might actually be completely and utterly wrong in a different circumstance.
So the lesson here is that you can't be too certain. A certain amount of indecision and questioning and indecisiveness is actually good.
Self-skepticism can be a very, very useful trait. And this is, you know, I think what's so important is to become aware of the larger bias at work here, which is that, you know, this goes by the name of cognitive dissonance too, which is that it's not nice to encounter facts that suggest you may be wrong, that suggest this really intricate model, which is the basis of your work, might actually be completely faulty. So what the human brain naturally tends to do is to ignore, to suppress, to disregard that kind of evidence. So unless you're aware of that bias, you're going to make the same mistake as the Israeli intelligence services did in 73 or that J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and Citibank did in 2003 through 2007.
Now, let's go back to the Israeli army for a second. They made this mistake, and they ended up not losing the war, although they were very close to losing this war. What did they do after that? They did something to sort of restructure essentially their brain, their sort of institutional brain.
Yeah, it's a little counterintuitive, and it's a very telling contrast with what the American intelligence services did after the failure before 9/11 and after the Iraq War, which is what the Israelis said is, okay, the problem here was this false consensus, that everyone was so sure of what they thought was going to happen, that the Arabs wouldn't attack, that the collective organization, the intelligence service as a whole, ignored all this relevant evidence. So what the Israelis decided to do was to basically come up with a whole new branch of the intelligence services, which was completely independent from the two pre-existing branches, so from the Israeli CIA and from the NSA, in other words. They created a whole third branch that the sole job of this third branch wasn't to gather more intelligence, because that clearly wasn't the problem. The Israelis managed to gather all these signals. They just ignored them after the fact. The sole job of this third branch was to simply be an independent source of analysis.
It was a devil's advocate, sort of.
A devil's advocate. It's a great way of putting it. Now that seems to have worked pretty well in the years since. There haven't been too many surprise invasions. There have certainly been lots of intelligence failures, but that's just part of the business, part of the job description.
But
it's a very different thing than what America did after 9/11, which was what America did was try to centralize intelligence.
To become more certain.
To become more certain, in a sense, was to minimize the competition between the CIA, the FBI, to minimize the dissonance. I also talk about some of the work done by Philip Tetlock, who's a psychologist at UC Berkeley, and he's done these long longitudinal studies, pretty epic stuff, where he followed hundreds of experts and asked them to make predictions over 15 years, make predictions about all sorts of events,
This is hedgehog stuff. Tell us about that. That's really interesting.
So Philip Tetlock, I think it was like 285 experts, political pundits, the guys you see on cable news, and he asked them to make predictions about every event from, would South Africa make a peaceful transition from apartheid? Will Quebec secede? Will George Bush be reelected? Stuff like that. All sorts of events, world events, political events. He asked them to predict the future, and he gave them three possible options. There are multiple choice predictions. And what he found is that the vast majority of experts are really bad at making predictions. That the vast majority of experts, these political pundits you see on cable news, they perform worse in random chance. So a monkey throwing darts at the answers will outperform these highly paid guys on MSNBC, Fox News, and CNN.
It's a good thing to remember when you're watching this channel.
Exactly. So that's the convenient moral we can all draw, which is that we shouldn't listen to, the guys on cable news.
And why are they wrong, though? Because it's something about the way that they're making their choices.
So that's the more subtle point, which I think is often lost when people discuss the work of Tetlock, which is that what made experts so spectacularly bad at making predictions was the sin of certainty we talked about, was that most experts, especially famous experts, the really famous ones, the guys who got paid lots of money, they were particularly bad, is that they were certain they were right. They had these rigid ideologies, these rigid theories, and they were very good at excusing facts which disconfirmed their ideology.
Like the Israeli army pre-1973.
Exactly. So they were what Tetlock, using a metaphor made famous by Isaiah Berlin, he called them hedgehogs, that they had one big idea and they clung to that idea no matter what. The facts, stubborn facts, they just brushed them away. They didn't let them trouble or contradict or change what they believed. The few experts who actually did well, who were pretty good at making predictions, Tetlock called them foxes. They were much more flexible. They were much better at seeking out disconfirming evidence, those dissonant facts. And they were very good at taking those facts into account. So instead of having one big theory, they had lots of little theories, and that allowed them to actually be much better and make predictions much more accurate.
So they were sort of more agile, and sort of mentally more agile in terms of allowing things to come in and change the way that they were thinking.
Exactly. And in particular, they seemed to be very good at actually taking into account inconvenient facts, which might trouble them, which might contradict what they often believed, what they liked to believe, what they would have liked to believe. And yet that's how you get more accurate, is by focusing on those inconvenient facts.
Right. One of the things you talk about is that a lot of decisions are actually best left to the emotional brain. Even sometimes the biggest decisions are best left to the emotional brain. You shouldn't try to break it down and become too logical about that. Talk about that a little bit. I found that fascinating.
I think the short way of encapsulating when we should trust our emotional brain, all right. this kind of unconscious activity, is in situations that involve lots and lots of information. And this gets back to, I think, one of the flaws of the rational brain, of the conscious deliberative thought process, is that you can only take in about 7 pieces of information at any given moment. You give them more than that, and it starts to short circuit, you know, like a computer running Windows Vista. So, you know, for decisions involving lots and lots of variables, you know, I mean, think about when you try to buy a car, how many things there are to think about. That if you ask your rational brain to try to assess all that information, it's not going to be able to do it, and it'll start cherry-picking facts. So that's one situation in which you should really learn to rely on your emotional brain. I think the other situation is situations in which you've got some experience and in which you know the domain. If you're a chess grandmaster, then you should go with your instincts when you're playing chess. If you're an NFL quarterback, Trust those subtle feelings you have about where to throw the ball. So if you've got experience, if you've taken the time to practice something, that practice, that experience is embedded in your emotional brain. And what we often refer to as kind of intuition, the intuition of the expert, is actually just, it's the predictions of your dopamine neurons, and they manifest themselves as these feelings. I mean, one of my favorite quotes in the book comes from Garry Kasparov, the chess grandmaster, who, when someone asked him how he decided which pieces to move and where, he said, I play by smell, by instinct, by feel.
And
that captures a bit, I think, one of the surprising things about experts, which is that I think we sometimes think about experts as what defines an expert is they're weighted down by all these explicit facts. They just know more. But when you actually look at how experts make decisions, that experts are actually profoundly intuitive. They're actually much more intuitive than beginners, and that's what makes them experts.
Right. But if you're a beginner, you shouldn't sort of – it's much harder to rely on your gut, I guess.
Exactly.
When you're a beginner, you can't just say, do this, buy this house.
Whatever. Because I'm not a chess grandmaster, because I don't play chess, I don't have chess instincts, trustworthy chess instincts I can rely on. If you ask me to be an NFL quarterback, I'll get sacked every time because I haven't taken the time to actually be able to read defenses in a snap, read defenses very quickly. All those kinds of instincts you can only accumulate through experience.
Right.
So I think too often we sometimes assume that we can just blink and trust our gut. You know, our intuition will take care
of
itself.
What you're saying is you have to do a lot of work to get to that point where
you have to educate your intuition.
Right.
You have to take the time to kind of embed these patterns into your emotional brain. If you haven't taken the time, then often they're just going to lead you astray.
Now, in the book, you talk about that you yourself can be very indecisive. Yes. Tell me a little bit about that.
I would really characterize it as pathologically indecisive, or maybe that's how my wife characterized it.
I can sympathize with that.
And you know, when you were talking about the Kung Pao shrimp versus the Kung Pao chicken, I was like, wow, that's a really hard decision. I was starting to sweat bullets over here just imagining that. One of the reasons I wrote the book, the particular epiphany for this book, came while actually I was standing in the cereal aisle of a supermarket, and this is something that happened to me all the time. Was you got like, there are 300 different cereals in the average supermarket, 100 yards of breakfast options. How do you know which one you want? So my wife sent me back. We'd gotten all our things there at the checkout counter. They're putting on the conveyor belt. And she sent me back with instructions to buy Cheerios. So I run back to the cereal aisle and I have to make a decision really quick.
There's a few Cheerios out there too, right?
I quickly discovered that was actually giving me instructions to just buy Cheerios was very, very difficult. Because do you buy the Honey Nut Cheerios, the regular Cheerios, the apple cinnamon Cheerios, the banana nut Cheerios? I mean, it's or the generic Cheerios.
So
she
had to come back and get you from the aisle.
So 15 minutes later, I see her in the corner of my eye looking at me like I've lost my mind because I still can't pick a box of Cheerios. So that's that was kind of the moment of insight where I realized, something's wrong. I got to figure out, number one, what was happening inside my head as I struggled and failed to pick a box of Cheerios. And number two, what should have been happening inside my head.
No, so you wrote this book. And it's not a how-to book, but there's some stuff in there about, how can – do things. Did it help you? I mean, are you better
it did.
With picking
I mean,
Cheerios now?
I am better. I'm still very much a work in progress, but I definitely have gotten better.
So what do you do? Like when you're at that paralyzing moment, which I have had a lot of times in my life, I can tell you, what do you do? What story do you tell yourself to get yourself to choose?
The thing which – has proven helpful to me. And again, this is all, there's no secret recipe here. It's about inculcating habits and changing yourself over time. That's why I'm, you know, as I said, I'm a work in progress. The thing that has proven helpful to me is actually a distinction made by Herbert Simon, the Nobel Prize winning psychologist, who he famously distinguished between maximizers and satisficers. Maximizers are people like, sounds like you and me, people who, we got to order the Kung Pao dish that's going to make us most happy. It's going to maximize our utility, maximize our happy. Yeah, we're consumer perfectionists. We're going to buy the box of Cheerios, which will just be the best possible box of Cheerios. And it turns out when you look at how maximizers actually rate their options and how satisfied they are, that maximizers, ironically, even though they set it to maximize their utility, are actually pretty unhappy, that they're always full of regret, that they're always thinking, oh, I bought the Honey Nut, but I should have bought the multigrain. So trying to maximize your utility is a really bad idea. What you should be is a satisficer. Satisficer the people who are, they realize that all the Kung Pao's are pretty good, right, all the Cheerios, they're all going to be tasty, that you should just simply try to find the option that's good enough, that will satisfy you and is not the best possible option.
Right.
So they're much less likely to experience regret. They're much, in general, much more satisfied with their options.
Wow.
So what I try to do, and this is easier said than done, is to try to be a bit more of a satisficer and a bit less of a maximizer. Just remind myself as I sit there eating my Honey Nut Cheerios, thinking about I should have bought the multigrain, that, you know, Honey Nuts are pretty good too.
What's that phrase, the perfect is the enemy of the good? I'm probably butchering it, but it's something like that.
I just was experiencing this yesterday as I was trying to pick a laundry detergent. I was trying to remind myself that, you know,
yesterday
I spent, you know, after a minute kind of, you know, that vague feeling of panic in the Target, which Tide should I buy? I remind myself that, you know, all these will probably work pretty well.
Right. So you just wrote this article for The New Yorker, this piece for The New Yorker about the neuroscience of self-control, which I found it fascinating. And you focus a lot of the story on the marshmallow experiment. Tell us a little bit about that.
This is a classic experiment done by Walter Mischel, then at Stanford. He's now at Columbia University. And this was done in the late 60s, early 70s, where he'd bring a four-year-old into his lab. He called them a game room. This is a very small room with a large one-way mirror. And he'd give the kids a choice. He could say you could have one marshmallow right away, or if you wait while I run an errand, you can have a second marshmallow. Not surprisingly, but every kid wanted to wait. They wanted the second marshmallow. But here's where you see this wide variation in terms of how long kids can actually wait.
That
some kids will eat the marshmallow before he left the room.
Wow.
Some kids will wait 30 seconds. Some kids will wait 2 minutes. The average waiting time at the original studies at Stanford were about 2.5 minutes.
So did he ever come back in, or he just went out and waited to see how long they would do it?
He would come back in. He gave the kids 15 minutes.
So it really was 15 minutes.
Yeah, so after 15 minutes, some kids were still waiting. He told a funny story about, you know, often the kids who could wait, they'd waited so long that they wouldn't even want to eat the second marshmallow. They were so proud of it, they would put it in their pocket for later. So those were the high delayers, the kids who could wait. Interestingly, what Mischel found was that the kids who could wait, they didn't necessarily have more willpower per se. They weren't better at gritting their teeth. What they were much better at was distracting themselves.
So they knew how to tweak their brain, essentially.
Yeah. So
it was not focused on the cookie.
Exactly. So they were the kids who would turn their back on the marshmallow. They were the kids who would play with their shoelaces, sing songs from Sesame Street, pretend to take a nap, pretend the marshmallow was a puffy cloud. They were the kids who realized that if they were thinking about how yummy the marshmallow was, they were going to eat it. What they had to do was to forget temporarily about the temptation.
Right.
So these are called metacognitive skills, and that, you know, these kids had a better understanding of how to think about the hot stimulus.
How to drive their brain in a certain direction.
Yes, how to distract themselves, how to control their thoughts so they could accomplish the long-term goal.
Right.
And it turns out that's a very important life skill. So when Mischel, 12 years later, went back and sent out questionnaires to the parents, teachers, and school administrators of all these children, more than 600 children, what he found was that how long you can wait as a four-year-old for a marshmallow, for a second marshmallow, is just about the most predictive test you can give a four-year-old.
For future success in life.
For future success, measured by all sorts of variables in terms of, you know, how many friends you have, how well you get along with your friends, how well you perform in school, how well behaved your teachers say you are, how likely you are to do drugs, if you've ever, you know, been in trouble with the law.
Where in the brain does the self-control lie?
Well, really what you're talking about is different parts of the frontal lobes, different parts of the prefrontal cortex.
And where is the frontal lobe? The frontal lobe is right above
Yeah, it's
eyebrows?
Is that basically it's kind of the overhang of brain behind the forehead, right. Behind the eyes. And there are a couple parts of the brain in particular, like the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which are particularly associated with willpower. And what's interesting is that when people say they're associated with willpower, it's not because they're the parts of your brain that allow you to kind of grit your teeth and exert willpower, not like the marshmallow. The reason these parts of the brain tend to associate it with right. these skills is that they're the parts of the brain that really control your attention. So they're the parts of your brain which say, you know, I got this hot stimulus here, this yummy marshmallow I'm trying not to think about. These parts of the brain, and some people say, well, okay, I don't want to think about the marshmallow. How can I direct my attention away from that? So the reason these brain areas are associated with willpower seems to be because they're actually associated. They actually control attention.
Got it.
So they actually modulate what you're thinking about. It's something called working memory. The stray thoughts you're actually conscious of at that moment. So when we talk about willpower, as John Janitis, one of the scientists I talked to, he says, you know, what willpower actually cashes out at in the real world is being able to control your attention. And so that's why these brain areas seem to be so important for delayed gratification, self-control, willpower in
it's
the real world.
So essentially sort of ability to focus is a key predictor of success. If you can focus on something, then that's you're going to do okay.
Yeah, well if you can focus on something, or alternatively notice that you can't focus on the marshmallow. And so the way to resist the marshmallow is to not focus on it. So being able to control...
You're focusing on not the marshmallow.
Exactly. Exactly. You're focusing on songs from Sesame Street. You're
right.
Focusing on your shoelaces. You're focusing on the color of the wall. You're focusing on everything
right.
but the temptation.
What do these experiments say? This is taking it a little bit beyond the article, but I'm curious what you think about this. What do your experiments say about Americans and American culture? I mean, we're a pretty undisciplined country in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, our savings rates are among the lowest in the world. We're among the most obese countries on the planet. I mean, is there something wrong with the brains of Americans? I'm just sort of curious about your thoughts
yeah.
on this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wouldn't blame the brain per se. I would blame the fact that as a culture we love convenience. We've made it so easy to indulge. I mean, it's just hard to walk down a city street without being confronted with endless ads for frappuccinos and mochaccinos
right.
and donuts and without walking down and smelling french fries. So we've got all these retail stores all they want to do is make the stimulus, the thing they're trying to sell, as hot as possible,
you know,
to use the jargon of a psychologist.
Right. We're surrounded by marshmallows.
We're surrounded by very tempting marshmallows. I mean, so one thing the psychologists have found is that one easy way to vastly increase delay time in a four-year-old is to simply cover the marshmallows. So the kid knows they're still there, but they're not as salient. They're not as visceral. They're not as hot. So just covering them makes a huge difference. A very seemingly irrelevant tweak makes a big difference to how long we can wait. And I think one thing that corporations have gotten very good at is kind of uncovering the marshmallows, so to speak,
right.
making them as tempting as possible.
So now in America, savings rates are going up a little bit,
yeah.
you know, sort of exponentially, but not, you know, they've gone from like -2 to 2 or whatever it is. So what's happening in the brains of Americans? I mean, is the prefrontal cortex getting activated? Is the
getting a little stronger?
Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing Walter mentioned, which I thought was a very interesting idea, is that I think we've become a little bit more sensitive to the consequences of not delaying gratification. So you drive down a neighborhood and you see signs for foreclosures. You watch the nightly news and you hear about unemployment lines. So I think one thing we've collectively as a society become more conscious of is,
right.
gosh, I really like that new iPod. I really love that sweater, but you know, maybe I can't afford it, and my credit card bill gonna show up in 30 days, and maybe I won't have a job then. So we're more aware and more sensitive to the possible negative consequences of indulging every whim.
Right.
You know, so I think temptation is now a little bit more balanced out by the consequences of indulging the temptation.
Well, this has been great. I've learned a lot about investing. I'm gonna be a better investor. I'm gonna be a better in the grocery store.
Better at the Chinese restaurant.
Yeah, better
too.
At the Chinese restaurant, I hope. That's a tough one, though. That's a really tough one. I have a hard time with that one. So before you go, though, I want to get back to what we mentioned at the beginning of our conversation. You've generously agreed to participate in this new interactive forum, and we're launching it this week, and Joan is going to be our first guest. The URL is theworld.org/science, and you can comment on what he said today, his book, Your Own Trials and Tribulations with Deciding Things. Best of all, Jonah himself is going to be regularly checking in, commenting, and responding to what you say. So go shoot your mouth off. The URL, again, is theworld.org/science. Thanks, Jonah. I'm looking forward to keeping this up online.
Thanks so much. Me too.
That was a lot of fun. Sometimes interviews are work, but that one was easy. I love that distinction between satisficers and maximizers. I'm definitely trying to reform my decision-making skills with that one. Now, if you want to read his New Yorker article, it's on their site, newyorker.com. Now we're going to turn to Elsa Youngstedt, who is our science news person. She was away for a week, and now she's back. Welcome back, Elsa.
Hi, David. Thanks.
So in case you're new here, Elsa works for Sigma Xi, which is a professional society that supports scientific research. She helps produce their free daily newsletter, Science in the News. And she's joining us from Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Now this week, let's start with a fish, cod. Iceland is one of the last places that still has a thriving cod fishery. But now there's a new study that says this fishery is headed for trouble.
Yep, cod in general have been doing badly for a while now. The huge cod fishery off Newfoundland collapsed in the early 90s and isn't recovering. And because fishing operations usually take the biggest fish, adult cod also aren't growing to be as big as they used to.
Now, this new study found that it's not just the big fish that are disappearing around Iceland, though. It's the shallow water fish, too.
Right. And for cod, habitat preference is mostly genetic. One gene in particular has a huge effect, and fish with one version of the gene spend their time in shallow water, less than 100 meters, and fish with a different version of the gene stay mostly in deep water.
I see. And the shallow water fish are probably more vulnerable to fishing, I bet.
Yep, exactly. The shallow water fish around Iceland have only 8% of the chance to survive and reproduce compared to the deep water fish. So the shallow water version of the gene is disappearing fast.
So what's going to happen? Are cod salvageable at all?
Unclear. I hope so. And the authors of this study say there should definitely be no fishing areas around Iceland very soon in order to protect them.
That's too bad. I love cod. Eating it, I mean. It's my favorite fish. It's so mild.
You may not be totally out of luck. Pacific cod, as far as I know, is still doing okay, at least for now.
Okay. That's good to know. That's good to know. Now, we have another food-related study this week. Researchers in France, of course, have done a chemical analysis that shows something that winemakers already knew, which is that the wine barrel affects how a wine tastes.
Yep, or here they're getting into differences that people may not even be able to taste. Here the researchers could tell, based on their analysis of the wine, which forest the barrel wood had come from.
Wow, so that's pretty good. How did they do that?
They were able to look at thousands of different compounds in the wines, and it also helped that they were working with wine made especially for this kind of study.
So wine's made just for the lab?
Yeah, I hope they got to drink some of it too. But these were four different kinds of wines, a Chardonnay, a Pinot Noir, a couple of others, and they divided each one into batches and aged each batch in different barrels made from oak that had come from nine different forests.
So the only difference between these wines was just the barrels then?
Exactly. So when they looked at the thousands of chemicals in each wine, they were able to tease out which ones came from specific forests.
Now, why do they even care if you can't even taste the difference?
I'm sure some people can taste the difference or would claim to, but if the chemical analysis gets cheaper, then the researchers say it could be a reliable sort of fact check to prevent people from selling wine under false labels.
Huh. Now let's switch from food back to decision making. Researchers in North Carolina, in Durham, which is just a few miles from where you are, I think, right, Elsa?
Mm-hmm.
They have this new study. They can tell from brain scans how rational or irrational you are, at least in this particular gambling game that they looked at.
Yeah, in this study, a couple of hundred participants did this game, and in the game, the researchers would present the subjects with the odds for some imaginary gamble. The chance of winning a certain amount, the chance of not winning anything, or the chance of losing some amount of money. Then the participants could choose among different ways to change their odds in that gamble.
So they could cut their risk.
Ah, so you're one of the rational decision makers. Minimizing loss would be the reasonable thing to do, to decrease the amount of the worst possible loss from your gamble. But really, only about a quarter of the subjects did that.
And what about the rest?
Most people focused on increasing their chances of winning something, even if it was small. So overall, this improved their odds of some gain, but it left the risk of loss exactly the same.
So they made the irrational choice then, and people mostly stuck to one strategy or the other.
Mostly, not 100%. But what's cool is that the researchers could tell from a brain scan which strategy a person would tend to use. If the reward centers of people's brains lit up a lot when they won real money, they were going to be maximize your chance of winning type people. But if their brains were less excited by reward, then they were the rational cut your loss types.
Now, this study was about economic decisions, but I wonder if the same principles apply to other things like, say, romantic decisions or political ones. Do people have the same kind of built-in strategies?
I certainly don't know, but maybe that's a question for Jonah when he's online this week.
Good call. Good call. That's something I'll have to ask him about in the forum. That's all the news we have for this week. So, Elsa, we'll see you in the forum. You're going to ask your share of questions, I'm sure.
All right. I'll be there.
Great. Take care. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye.
That's it for this week. I'm going to leave you with another song about decision-making. This is Amy Mann. The song is No Choice in the Matter. Don't forget to visit the forum. The link, again, is theworld.org/science. We're also on Facebook, The World Science Podcast. And send us email, questions for Jonah, or whatever else is on your mind having to do with science. david.kohn@bbc.co.uk. We'll see you next week. Take care.
Support for the World Science Podcast comes from the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin, nsf.gov, and the Amgen Foundation, which seeks to advance science education, improve access to care, and strengthen Amgen's communities. More at amgen.com. You leave me no choice in the matter.